Hey, Matt.
Hey, Ross.
How are
How's it going? I'm good. And I think we do formal introductions now.
Oh, we do formal introductions. It's been so long. I'm Ross Douthat. I'm an op-ed columnist for the New York Times, and this is my return to Blogging Heads, which I didn't do while I wasn't blogging, because it seemed like, you know, you can't do Blogging Heads if you aren't blogging. And that's not really true, but that was the theory that I had. But now I'm back, and you are.
I am Matthew Iglesias with the Center for American Progress, I've been Blogging Heads consistently since basically the dawn of time.
Actually, you were the first person, you introduced me to Blogging Heads.
Exactly.
You were the purveyor of the gateway drug that, you know.
That is, yes, fake web television.
I think I think in our first Blogging Heads we talked about what the J.J. Abrams Star Trek reboot would be like, and that was like 2 years before it actually came out. So
exactly.
So we were ahead of the curve.
Way ahead of the curve.
Yeah.
Way ahead.
But speaking of ahead of the curve, I guess we should start off by talking about saving the Earth from impending cataclysm, which is the subject of various talks and consultations this week in Copenhagen, right?
Yes. Well, not just this week. This is
it's a
terrifyingly long conference.
Right. It's the 7th to the 18th.
Something like that. It's like the longest conference I've ever heard of. I don't know.
People like Scandinavia, as you discovered on your trip this year. They go there and they just want to stay.
I do like Scandinavia, but I will say last December I was in I was in Finland, which is near Scandinavia.
Right, I know, and the Finns
and
don't.
It's,
And Denmark, wait, is Denmark technically part of Scandinavia too?
Denmark is.
Denmark
yes.
is. Finland isn't.
Right. But at any rate, right. they're all Nordic. And what I was going to say is that just December, in Helsinki at least, it was really, really dark all the time. Not the best vacation spot. I was in Copenhagen back in October, and it was pretty nice, but still fairly dark. I think by now, you know, 2 weeks subjected to that kind of, 6 hours of daylight regime may kind of get the international negotiators pretty depressed.
Well, and you're also, I saw you, I think you posted that you were a little worried about, you know, they're in Scandinavia where it's really, really cold. And so you're looking forward to headlines saying...
Well, I mean, of course, we fear a snowstorm.
Right.
You know, there was some... I mean, last winter, someone scheduled some big, you know, like youth climate event or something in Washington, D.C., and, you know, of course, it snowed. So then, of course, there were posters of these people who were saying global warming is bad, and they were surrounded by snow.
Right.
I think, of course, you know, if you understand the issue correctly, the point is not that there will never be cold weather anywhere in the future, but still it's bad, and... If you actually look at surveys, the research appears to indicate that, you know, people's level of concern about climate change goes up in the summer and goes down in the winter.
Right.
Which, again, is not, you know, strictly relevant, but, you know, it gets people thinking one way or another. You know, I think ideally you would have these climate summits on, like, small tropical Pacific islands. So, you know, people could say, like, well, here we are, it's nice now, but if we were underwater, that would suck.
Right.
Rather than, you know, Denmark.
Or they could just host them all in New Orleans.
Yes, New Orleans. Solid.
I think if you look at least in terms of domestic public opinion, it seems like
yes.
Hurricane Katrina had the strongest sort of galvanizing effect on public belief in global warming.
Right. I mean, which is interesting because it's not... I mean, what Hurricane Katrina is relevant to is just the reminder that sort of climate has strong impact on human well-being.
Right.
You know, which, of course, you know, people's sort of beliefs in the underlying science tend to track sort of underlying political commitments so that when the economy goes bad and people decide maybe they don't care as much about environmental issues... They don't just want to say, like, well, I'm greedy and selfish. They want to decide, not only do I care less about this because I'm worried more about my mortgage, but also, you know, oh, the science is all wrong
right. And
this isn't even happening. So, yeah, I mean...
Right, I mean, it doesn't necessarily help when the biggest economic downturn in the last 50 years or so happens to coincide with a decade in which, let's say, temperatures have not been increasing as rapidly as they were.
Well,
to the extent they have been increasing, right?
I will say the World Meteorological Union, something, World Meteorological, and then there's another word, came out with a report on this, and I mean, what happened is that 1998, I think, remains the hottest year on record. So in that sense, you know, there has not been the further temperature increases, but the average temperature,
right? The average temperature is still higher than the average
temperature.
It's still
higher than in the '90s, which was
right. But, well, I mean, but what you're getting when you graph it, right, is what looks like a kind of plateauing across the last 10 years at a point that's higher than where temperatures were in the '80s. But in terms of the experience, it's not inaccurate to say that the experience of the last 10 years as opposed to the experience of the 80s and 90s has been of less appreciable warming, right?
I think that's right. I would have to look back at it. But I mean, yes, and of course, right, I mean, obviously the best sort of newspaper headline you would have would be to say 2009 is the hottest year on record, you know, which it wasn't. Instead, 1998 keeps being the hottest year on record.
Right.
Whereas the easiest way to dramatize this is to say, you know, talk about new records that are being broken. But that's not what's going on. Instead, there's, I don't know, records that have to do with ice. Not the kind of thing people
right.
You
right.
Know,
there's still right. There's continuing. Yeah. There's continuing ice problems. You could say.
I mean, a lot of stuff happens.
Right. Well, let me ask you a couple things then. I mean, first of all, what's your sense of the sort of state of play going into Copenhagen, right? Because for a while, I mean, I think in terms of sort of the domestic political debates of the United States, there's definitely a sense that the push for sort of carbon emission limits is kind of back on its heels at the moment because of the recession, because of the, you know, leaked climate emails. I don't know, you know, I think it's hard to say to what extent that's filtered down into the general public, but certainly that's there. And maybe because of climate trends the last 10 years. And then when Obama went on his trip to Asia, there was a lot of coverage saying, oh, this trip is unsuccessful because he's not getting, you know, he's not getting to where he needs to be with the Chinese and the Indians in terms of cutting deals with them, you know, where we restrain our emissions, they restrain their emissions, and so on. But now it seems like in the last week or so there have been people saying, no, that's not true. A lot of progress was made on that trip and in general, and that, you know, and that the Obama administration at least is hopeful of coming out of Copenhagen with something more impressive. And I'm wondering what you think that something more impressive would look like.
Yeah, I mean, well, so there were big steps forward with India to an extent, and particularly to China. So, you know, there's a realistic chance of an agreement sort of in broad terms in which countries set goals, as they did at Kyoto, but that would include the United States and would also include China and India, which would be the sort of thing, you know, that would be a global agreement that gets you where you need to go. I think the extent of the commitments is not going to be where the IPCC wants them to be. Of course, the domestic political context in the United States, you know, is sort of a different thing. You know, and one factor I would point to there, in addition to what you said, is just the changing attitude of John McCain. The fact that once upon a time, you know, he was very interested in this issue and interested in having a bill with his name on it and be the architect of a bipartisan solution to this sort of mind-boggling problem, you know, was an important part of the legislative debate. His sort of defection from that coalition, you know, which at first looked maybe like a kind of election year gambit, but now seems to have hardened post-election for various reasons, you know, is a real challenge. I mean, you can get a healthcare vote through the Senate with 60 Democratic votes and zero Republicans. You're not going to be able to do a successful climate bill in that way. So unless more people can be brought along with Lindsey Graham's sort of brand of nuclear conservatism, you know, it's very hard to see how this happens. And I think, you know, while of course Americans care about what China and India agree to, that's not ultimately decisive to our own politics.
Right. Well, I mean, one question it seems to me that's been kicked back and forth a lot by liberals and some conservatives, and it was kicked back and forth on the Times op-ed pages this week, is this debate over, you know, cap and trade versus a carbon tax.
Right.
And on that front, you have in the sort of in the world of policy wonks, you have a lot of wonks who are in favor of a sort of more transparent, simple carbon tax as opposed to cap and trade, especially now that we see what a cap and trade bill looks like after it's gone through the legislative process. And you also there have, I mean, that's the place where you get some right of center people, pundits and wonks, usually rather than politicians, saying this is where, you know, Democrats could get some Republicans on board and so on if only they were willing to go with a simple carbon tax instead of the unwieldy cap and trade mess that we got. And the response from you, among others, has been, and from my colleague Paul Krugman and so on, is that, you know, we're in a situation where, you know, sure, in an ideal world there would be a carbon tax maybe rather than cap and trade, but the political, you know, the votes aren't there, one. And two, what I think you would say is that the sort of conservative support for a carbon tax is a kind of notional support, right, and has no actual political purchase.
Right. For one thing, I think, you know, I think to pose this as a difference between, like, a cap and trade and a carbon tax is a little that's not, I think, the central difference. I mean, the difference is between a relatively clean, efficient system,
right,
which could be done with cap and trade or could be done with carbon tax, or a very kind of messy one with a lot of side deals, which is what we're getting with cap and trade. But you're Jim Manzi has sort of pointed out, you know, there's no reason a carbon tax couldn't also have all kinds of
side deals, right?
Bad side deals. So the question is, side deals or not? And it's, of course, it's sort of easy to sort of say as a, you know, analyst, oh, well, the Democrats, you know, their bill has too many side deals, so it's bad. It does have too many side deals. If what you had was a block of, you know, if you had 5 or 6 Republican senators sitting together saying, like, really, you know, if you cut 60% of the side deals out of this proposal, then we'll support it. I think that would be great. We might get some of these side deals out. But, you know, in the House process, the bill started, the one that Waxman and Markey wrote initially, was a pretty clean bill without a lot of these kind of giveaways. And it's not as if huge numbers of House Republicans were leaping to sign on for it. So what happened was, is they said, well, here's our bill, here's our block of votes. You know, the bidding is open, right? I mean, whoever can show up with a block of people who say, we will vote for this if you make this change, we will listen to. And, you know, and the people who wanted to bargain were Democrats from coal states, Democrats from agricultural areas. So those are the bargains that were made. You know, had Republicans shown up with, you know, sort of not just overall objections to the project, but actual concessions they wanted, you know, I think... Certainly, I think Henry Waxman would have liked better to be in the position to have more possible suitors. But, you know, Republican politicians don't seem super interested in that kind of thing. They think this is an unpopular idea.
Right.
They can oppose it and, you know, win elections. Which isn't a crazy... I mean, I think that's bad, but, I mean, it's not like a ludicrous calculation.
No, I mean, and I think it reflects a broader political dynamic right now that you also certainly saw on healthcare, where, you know, you had at least, I mean, there you did in theory have a block of Republican senators who had signed on to a healthcare bill that a lot of people thought was considerably better than the healthcare bill we're likely to get, right? Which is to say, Wyden Bennett.
Right.
In theory, that bill had seven Democratic sponsors and 7 Republican sponsors. So that's, you know, that's a step further than
yeah.
It's not necessarily a step further because you did have the McCain-Lieberman climate bill, but it's certainly a step forward. It's certainly further than further than you are with a carbon tax or cap and trade, really. And there, you know, you could say there was a decision taken, and I think that there was by the Democratic leadership to you know, not try and build on that kind of, you know, that compromise and to pursue a very different kind of bill. But the counterargument, which you would make and have made, right, is that bill wasn't real, and that the political dynamic at the moment is that ultimately those, you know, of those seven Republican co-sponsors, five would find reasons not to actually vote for a health care package, you know, that looked like Wyden-Bennett, right?
Well, and some of them, I mean, had said it, right, that they were signed on as co-sponsors, but that
they reserved the right to...
They voiced specific objections. I mean, I think Bob Bennett was, as Ron Wyden was, were both perfectly sincere in trying to pursue their vision. But, you know, people... It was, from the beginning, a slightly pie-in-the-sky-ish, bill. It was the kind of thing wonks come up with, where you radically change everything all at once, which is part of its appeal, but also part of its appeal, I think, to senators. I mean, I think Democrats, too, among the co-sponsors, was precisely the idea that, you know, it wasn't really a realistic proposal.
Right.
They weren't going to be asked to vote on it. And what you saw, I mean, as the process unfolded, right, was Ron Wyden tried to bring an amendment to Max Baucus's bill that would have sort of substantially, well, made it more like the Wyden-Bennett bill. And some Democrats didn't like that idea because a lot of union leaders don't like how that would work.
Right.
So what Wyden was hoping to do was get Republicans to say, oh, no, you know, like if you do what Ron Wyden wants, then we'll vote for the bill.
Right.
Which would have been a way for Republicans to, you know, stick it to the unions, make a bill that, even if they didn't like, would have been sort of better by their lights.
Right.
But they didn't want to do it, right? I mean, because they don't want to act like a party that's reconciled itself to minority status and is looking to sort of
improve,
cut deals
right.
with Democrats.
Right.
They want to act like a party that thinks it's going to... make big gains in the near term, and so they're going to, you know, take an oppositional line, say that, you know, policy trajectory they don't support is bad, and come in, and it's, you know, it's frankly what a lot of, you know, liberal bloggers like me were urging Democrats to do after 2004,
what they did roughly, certainly what they did with Social Security reform, but...
I think it's mostly what they did... I mean, more and more what starting in 2005
right.
they started to do. It's very different from the strategy they pursued in 2001,
right, 2000,
2003.
Certainly on foreign policy it's very different, yes. But it is a little bit different with, you know, the difference between Social Security reform and, like, Medicare Part D, for instance, is that Medicare mm-hmm. Part D is something that Democrats really, really did support.
Right.
I mean, not in, you know, the final form which it took, but it wasn't mm-hmm. a case of something, you know, where they were trying to make something that they were fundamentally uncomfortable with a little bit better. And in the end, they ended up all... I mean, and the other thing is that, you know, Medicare Part D Democrats basically all voted against it anyway.
Right, although I think the biggest example is probably the first round of Bush tax
right.
cuts, which got a lot of Democratic votes,
right.
even though I think everyone understands that if Al Gore had been elected president... It's, you know, the people who wound up voting for the Bush tax cut bill would not have been, like, leaning heavily on Al Gore to pass a similar piece of legislation. But they said, you know, the Republicans, like, really wanted Democrats to vote for the bill. And so in exchange for getting a bunch of Democrats to vote for it, they tilted the distributive impacts to some extent. They made the overall package slightly smaller.
Right.
You know, liberals were really furious.
Right. But this was also...
You know, it's hard to say.
But the Democrats who voted for it also voted for it because they felt themselves to be politically vulnerable. And part of the issue now is that there just aren't that many... There were more politically vulnerable Democrats for Bush
yes.
to co-opt than there are... I mean, this is the... You know, it's the burden... The burden of having the opposition party be a rump is that you have fewer people to cut deals with.
Right. I mean,
the Democrats...
Part of it is that a lot of the remaining Republicans represent very conservative states. I mean, you know, Jeff Sessions doesn't care what Barack Obama wants him to do.
Right.
And the other thing, though, is that the Democrats... I mean, I think people sort of don't pay enough attention to this story because it's a non-event. But the last two cycles, Democrats had, I think, totally good, plausible challengers to Susan Collins and to Olympia Snow, and they both lost really badly. I mean, in a way that really emphasizes that, you know, the main Republicans are seemingly moderate enough for the voters of Maine.
Right.
Even though their state in other respects seems to be considerably more left-wing than Susan
right.
Collins. So they're just not under pressure the way that Democrats...
Right, they're not under pressure the way Ben Nelson was or something. But that said, I mean, Susan Collins and Olympia Snow are the two Republicans who have shown a willingness to cut deals. They aren't cutting deals...
Exactly.
Exactly the deals that you might want them to cut, but they are... You know, they are at the table in a way that Jeff Sessions
right.
isn't.
Well, and it's not a coincidence. I mean, because I think clearly their political position relies in part on them not having the public persona
right.
of relentless opposition to Barack Obama. They want to be at a minimum seen as engaged in some kind of good faith bargaining process. They're just not, you know, as vulnerable as people in their position, you know, otherwise might be, or even you might think they were had Tom Allen not run last time around.
Right.
You know what I mean? You might be in a position where Olympia Snow is sitting there thinking, oh man, you know, if the Democrats ever get like a solid candidate,
right, against
me, maybe I'll lose, but they had one.
Right. And they
had
one
in a great year
for
Democrats.
Right.
And he got crushed.
Yeah.
I mean, so.
Well, we've gotten a little bit, you know, we've been talking about the politics of all this. I wanted to just press you a little bit on your sense broadly. I mean, obviously you have a very high comfort level with the broad strategy of environmentalist liberalism, and I wonder how confident you feel and why you feel so confident in the kind of cost-benefit analyses that go into whether it's, you know, the cap and trade system that the U.S. passed, or any kind of, you know, broader global regime that does something similar, because this is where I think the interesting
right.
debate is on this issue, right? It's not necessarily in the, you know, debates about whether researchers bent the hockey stick graph a little
sure.
bit, which, you know, they may have done, and the climate science, you know, may be being presented as more settled than it actually is, but it's still, you know, it's still reasonably settled science. The question that frankly I have about all of this is always to what extent is the regime we're likely to get, given global politics as it is, likely to do anything effective about global warming in general, and two, to what extent is any regime likely to produce costs that really exceed its benefits? And so I wonder what you lean most heavily on in, because I mean, I think one thing a lot of people lean on is simply just hedges against worst case scenarios, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's something to that, but I do think that the main thing is that the costs of an optimal policy are really not that high, which I think is important, and I think it's not that well understood. You know, people. But if you look at it, if you look at the Stern Report or other things done by economists, the, you know, level of costs that the developed world is being asked to bear are really quite low. I mean, the costs to certain specific individuals are potentially quite dramatic.
Right.
But if anyone thinks about their individual life, you know, if you had a somewhat smaller, somewhat cheaper house, but it had much more expensive, fancier furniture in it, you know, it's not like for Americans who live in really, really giant houses, and often have really ugly crap in their houses. It's not like that would be some, you know, crippling disability in life. People don't do it, as they do because, you know, they respond to the situation that exists, the legal framework that exists. You know, I think the strong point, this is where though the argument gets a little loopy, but is that, you know, the strong point that sort of skeptics of environmental policy make is that the policies that seem likely to emerge are not optimal policies. You know, they are much more economically costly than alternative ways to create the same level of emissions reduction, to which you then, you know, I'm then inclined to say, well, look, you know, if people complaining about the nature of these bills were working to make the bills better rather than joining forces with the sort of, you know, people who want to veto any action, then maybe we could get better bills. And then we kind of all spin our wheels around. So I do try as a writer to both emphasize the fact that, you know, I think it's important to reduce carbon emissions and also to try to write about, you know, which ways of doing this are, I think, economically sound.
Right.
You know, what actually happens in the world, it's, you know, it's hard to say. Life is so
well,
depressing.
Right. It's and you are also dealing with, I mean, one of the problems with climate change, right, is that it's easier to argue that, you know, to try and convince, from your vantage point, right, you can say, okay, well, if the sort of, you know, if the sort of smartest right-of-center critics of cap-and-trade were joining forces, and if they brought five or six Republican senators along with them, you could imagine a kind of, you know, maybe a kind of American consensus that produces a more optimal piece of legislation. But that's, you know, I mean, you've got America, and then you have to try and imagine doing the same thing with actors like China, Russia, India, and so forth, where it's one step harder than just sort of saying, well, we need, you know, more conservative pundits to be in favor of an optimal carbon tax because that will bring Lindsey Graham along. I mean, bringing Lindsey Graham along is presumably a lot easier than bringing China along.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, I think the thing that's beneficial, for not beneficial, but, you know, China, well, for one thing, because it's a dictatorship, its policy could kind of pivot in a way that, you know, a democracies can't. But the other thing is that I think it's actually much easier to adopt policies that steer your development in a energy-efficient way than it is to take a huge, giant set of built infrastructure and transform it into something else. You know, Americans have these sort of enormous fixed investments in our houses, our office buildings, our parking garages, things like that, which, you know, people are reluctant to give up, obviously, because they, you know, they were built and purchased at oftentimes at great expense. The Chinese are in the process of very rapidly rebuilding new things, and they fully intend to, you know, try over the next 20 years to scrap as much of their old terrible housing as they can. And so building it up to a better standard is, I think, in some ways a much more attractive proposition for them. And the so, you know, it's complicated.
It's complicated,
I mean, India,
though, because the flip side of that is what you were just saying, which is true, that the marginal value of economic growth lost to climate caps, right, is relatively low for citizens of the United States. The marginal cost for the average Chinese person is a lot higher because and this is true across the developing world, this is why it's such a thorny issue. You're dealing with countries where, you know, I mean, at a certain point, you know, one of the things that it's much easier to do in the developed West is say, yeah, we want to trade a certain level of wealth for, you know, cleaner air and so on. And that trade makes sense. But it makes more sense once you've hit a certain level of wealth that a lot of people in China and India haven't hit yet.
Well, and particularly India. I mean, if you look at, I mean, people tend to say China and India, negotiating stances of the Chinese and the Indians is quite different, with the Indians being a lot less cooperative, in part because they're substantially poorer, and in part
because they're a democracy and have to
Oh, but. Also just because their economy is structured differently, like very, very, very differently. It has much more dependence on sort of, you know, small-scale enterprises. They don't – yeah, I mean, they're a democracy, so it's harder for them to switch. Although, you know, I mean, sometimes this is posed as a question of, you know, the interest of the developed world in sort of fancy things like clean air versus the developing world that – you know, wants to build factories and get richer. But the people who will be hurt hardest by out-of-control climate change are also people in the developing world. Generally not people in China, but people in Indonesia, people in Bangladesh, people in Africa.
Right. This is sort of what I was getting at earlier, though, right? That has to be a big part of the argument for this. I mean, because part of it is...
Right.
It seems to me that there are So the baseline skeptic's argument, right, is that, yes, it's true that, say, a cap-and-trade system you know, to take the CBO's analysis, it reduces GDP by between 1% and 3%, right, by 2050.
Relative.
I forget the exact number, right? But relatively small numbers for a very rich country like the United States. The flip side of that, though, is that the cap and trade system doesn't get you anywhere close to the ideal levels of emissions reductions that you need to really, really halt or reduce global warming. And further, if you look at the sort of baseline estimates that someone like the IPCC makes about the cost in GDP of the expected amount of warming over the next 100 years, it's also a relatively small number. You're, again, talking about one to 5% of global GDP. So you're essentially, I mean, so this is the skeptic's argument, right? You're essentially saying, yeah, the cost to the United States are relatively small, but the benefits are even smaller, and the danger to be forestalled isn't large enough to take on this high cost, low benefit system. And it seems to me the answer to that has to be, right, that either one, you're hedging against truly catastrophic warming, or two, it's a distributional issue and you just have to, you know, that 4% loss of GDP falls so heavily in terms of, you know, people dead from tsunamis that you have to do it.
Right. Well, and I mean, I do think it's worth being clear about that, right? I mean, if the fact is poor people, I mean, in the sense of globally poor people, just contribute very little to world, you know, economic output. So if the whole nation of Bangladesh all dropped dead tomorrow, the economic impact of that would be actually quite tiny. But you'd still be talking about 100 million people dead, which I think most people would think, you know, so if there was a meteor headed for Bangladesh, and, you know, obviously Bangladesh does not have the astronomical, you know, capacity to send Ben Affleck up there and save them, that this would be a reasonable thing for the United States of America to try to undertake. But in part, Americans sort of like heroic, you know, action movie type scenarios in which we, at great expense, like fly out to this asteroid and save Bangladesh, and are not that interested in kind of like long, steady work of pollution reduction. But it's, you know, I think a structurally similar situation that, yeah, I mean, does, I mean, the extreme scenarios are relevant, but I mean, you really do have to take into consideration, you know, the impacts on very poor people who, you know, I don't know what to say. Their lives matter, you know, morally.
Well,
speaking,
right,
but economically.
But so do they. I mean, this, you know, saying, well, the U.S. will just, you know, we'll take a 2% hit in terms of GDP and so on. You know, the growth of the United States and its economic well-being also can't really be separated from the growth and economic well-being of the global economy and of countries in the developing world. And you are dealing with, again, with a situation where the marginal benefits of having global growth be 3% higher over the next 50 years are likely to be felt more strongly by countries like Bangladesh too. I mean, you're not, you know, it's,
well,
no, you,
I don't really think that's right. I mean, if you look at the developing world, well, you know, so certain countries get sort of their own.
Well, certainly this has been
in order and get on the kind of growth train. At the same time, I mean, it would be hard to say that, you know, people living in Africa have derived, you know, any benefit whatsoever from the West getting rich.
That's not true. I mean, if you look at standard, I mean, even in Africa, right? Like, you've got, you know, better public health overall. I mean, you had, particularly in the post-colonial era, I think, you know, you had real countries taking real steps backwards. But in the,
right,
in the, you know, 25 or 30 years of growth we had between, and again, large generalizations here, between the 70s and the current economic collapse, I'm pretty sure that even in Africa, you are getting substantial benefits in terms of rising per capita GDP, rising standards of living, you know, better health care, et cetera. I mean, again, it's happening on the margins, and the gap between the health care available to the average European and the average African has probably grown substantially since 1952, but the average African is still getting better health care. And I mean,
healthcare. Yeah. Well, okay. We'll have to look up.
We don't have the statistics.
I was going to say though, sort of by way of pivoting in into the next thing.
Right. That, we've talked about
one of the ways in which the West getting richer has definitely helped people living in the poor countries is that many people from poor countries have been able to move into rich countries and do jobs there that, you know, as a result of development in North America and Europe, you know, people don't want to do low-wage labor. So low-wage laborers have come from Mexico, from Africa, from the Arab world, and have generally made themselves much wealthier than they otherwise would have been. And, of course, that's an independent policy variable and very politically controversial everywhere that we have large numbers of immigrants,
right.
especially
in Europe. We can talk about Europe's problem with Muslim immigrants, if it has such a problem, right?
Well, there's definitely some. I am not personally inclined toward Christopher Caldwell levels of sort of hysteria / despair about the situation, but it's, you know, I've been in Europe a number of times over the past year and a half, thought about it a lot, and I do think for sort of liberal Americans who are accustomed to talking about various admirable aspects of sort of European policy environment, it's striking that on issues of sort of race, cultural diversity, that the United States is light years ahead of what's taking place in Europe, where levels of integration seem very low, but also just levels of racism are staggering, really. And the United States has obviously had a sort of a bad legacy of racial issues, but that's in part because we have, in fact, had racial diversity throughout our history and have done a lot to work through this and get a situation where, you know, there's a black man who's president and, you know, you're not going to have serious politicians running, you know, explicit running the kind of racist campaigns.
Right, there's that poster you like to show on your blog.
Yeah,
it's the sheep, or is it
Switzerland? Well, it's Switzerland has a sheep one. Then there's Italy, where there's one where it's like crazy, like sort of like minstrel show looking guys are like shoving grandpa out of line in the hospital. Yeah, you know, just stuff.
Right, stuff you don't even see in a close contested house race in Arizona.
Yeah,
things
that I think, you know, vaguely resemble stuff that you might have seen in the late 60s or early 70s, but would have been considered really extreme and outre even then. I mean, there's no comparison. And also in the way people talk. I mean, I don't know.
Well, right. And this is, I think, where, this is where I'm in. I mean, the interesting thing about Christopher Caldwell's book, I think, is that it received, the book is Reflections on the Revolution in Europe. I talked about it in my column this week, but it received much better reviews, or many more reviews and much more favorable attention from sort of what you might call the liberal or centrist press than did the slew of books that had preceded it from right-wingers and some sort of liberals like Bruce Bauer who have sort of functionally right-wing views about this subject. You know, Melanie Phillips, obviously Mark Stein's book was hugely successful, but it was not receiving, you know, it was not being reviewed
not
in the New York Review of Books. Caldwell's
right.
book got a critical review in the New York Review of Books, but Caldwell's book was taken seriously in a way those books weren't.
Mm-hmm.
I think Caldwell's book is head and shoulders the best of them, but it is making very similar arguments. I think that one of the distinctions, though, is that Caldwell does not then take the step towards making predictions about, you know, the sort of long-run Islamification of Europe, the sort of, you know, the Eurabia thesis,
Also, Caldwell has spent all this time in Europe and sort of knows what he's talking about with a much more fine-grained kind of way.
Well, yeah, although some of these books, I mean, a lot of the people writing about the subject. A lot of the other conservatives, the sort of, you know, Melanie Phillips
or
is in Europe.
Claire
Berlinski is in Europe, I think. Bruce Bauer was prompted to write his books by having moved to Scandinavia, to Sweden, to live with his partner, and then discovering. Anyway, look, Caldwell is a very smart guy and a very serious observer, but I think he's also, you know, his book is very pessimistic without making sort of sweeping predictions about how, you know, France is going to be an Islamic republic in 2075 and so on. But I tend to think that that's, you know, I think that that's basically, I mean, that's the view I take as someone who has traveled less and is less knowledgeable about these issues than Caldwell and probably than yourself, that, you know, the right way to look at Europe's experience with Islamic immigration is that it is, you know, not something that's going to destroy the European Union. It's something that has created a kind of problem that hadn't really existed in Europe before, of a kind of a large underclass that's culturally alienated from the broad spectrum of European life, and an underclass that's growing even as Europe's overall population plateaus and or shrinks, and an underclass that it's going to be very, very difficult to assimilate successfully.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the good news about this is that I think that the sort of upsurge in explicit concern about this, it in part reflects the fact that to an extent the corner has been turned, and that the biggest part of the problem for a very long time was this kind of weird denial about it, where the sort of official line from a lot of governments was that these people, you know, don't really live here and are all going to go home.
Right.
And, you know, the important thing is that you have a kind of, like, very strict kind of official anti-racism combined with totally run amok, like, actual on-the-ground social racism combined with total denial on a public policy level that, you know, anything needs to be done to sort of address the situation, because really they're just guest workers. Whereas now, I mean, this has moved to the center of the European political debate, often in ugly kinds of ways, but it means that the first step is admitting that you have a problem, as they say. And, you know, Germany, I know over the past little while, as a result of sort of alternation between political parties in power, has, I think, started to, like, wend its way free of this problem. You know, the left was in, and they did some stuff to make it much easier for Turkish people who want to become German citizens to become German citizens. Then the right came in, and they kind of clamped down on the public assistance benefits that are available to non-citizens. You know, so that's the kind of, like, you know, ebbing and flowing of political contestation that gets you to a point where you're saying, you know, you should, like, really sign on for Germany and participate, which is, you know, I mean, what you need on some level, I think.
Right. Yeah. No, I don't disagree. I think just one of the questions, though, is, you know, I mean, there were decades of the kind of failed policy approach that you describe, and it's created a sort of deep, you know, a deep underlying issue that tracks with issues in European demographics and so on, and means that, you know, I think the answer is, as you say, a kind of slow grinding policy that acknowledges there is a problem, that, you know, balances some sort of, you know, that balances the sort of the left's generosity with the right's, you know, authority, if you will, and that, you know, yeah, that basically tries to grind it out, because obviously you're not, you know, the decisions that were taken cannot be untaken, and but I do think that there is, you know, there, I think where Caldwell, you know, where Caldwell is right, is that I think that, you know, there was just a, to my mind, a massive underestimation of the kind of potential cultural gulf. And I think the cultural gulf has been widened by the experience of immigration, where you have sort of the experience of being an isolated population in a, you know, decaying Parisian suburb, actually leads people to become more sort of radically, zealously Islamic or Islamist than they would have been in their home countries. And there is a large underestimation just of how hard, I mean, if you look at the American experience with Hispanic immigration, right, you know, whatever your views on Hispanic immigration, it's clear that, you know, even with a population that has historic ties to the United States, that shares a religion that's, you know, one of the major religions of the United States, Roman Catholicism, and that's lived next door to the U.S. for generations, you still have huge assimilation problems. I think that, you know, all of those problems are compounded by the fact that, you know, in the case of Europe, you're dealing with a population that is, I mean, you know, I think you can clearly oversell, and many people on the right do, the kind of, you know, clash of civilizations element, but there is a clash of civilizations element. I mean, you know, you see this most explicitly in the debates about admitting Turkey to the EU, but more broadly, you know, I mean, Islam and the Islamic Mediterranean and Christian Europe had been engaged in a sort of cold, hot war for all of history.
Yeah, I mean, I would not go nearly that far, but obviously it's substantial cultural difference. You know, and I think probably the better comparison, and a comparison that ultimately leaves me feeling optimistic, is not to the current immigration to the United States, but to the pre-World War I immigration to the United States, when Catholics from Southern and Eastern Europe were, at that time, really were perceived as belonging to a very alien religious and cultural paradigm of Catholicism. We're also, I mean, it's funny if you look at cartoons and stuff from them. I mean, the perception among, you know, sort of mainstream Northern European-derived Americans was that there were these, like, extremely large, visibly obvious physical differences between sort of native stock Americans and Italians and Slavs, things like that. And at the same time, you also had, I mean, it's been completely forgotten in contemporary life because it turned out not to be relevant. But there was this enormous wave of terrorist violence associated with the anarchist political movement, mostly emanating from the Catholic South and East of Europe, that for a while, until World War I and the Bolshevik Revolution, appeared to be this huge security problem. You know, they were killing presidents and kings, they were blowing stuff up, there was enormous, you know, civil liberties crackdowns, there were liberals who were, you know, outraged by the treatment of people. Right. Everyone was freaking out. I kind of think, I mean, this is probably a subject for another day's blogging heads, but that, you know, Al-Qaeda is gonna kind of go down as the anarchists of our time, and you know, this political violence that you see some of in Europe associated with alienated Muslim communities is very scary to people, as of course, you know, it would be, but I think there's a tendency to see it as like the harbinger of bigger and much worse kind of violent conflict, when it should be seen as a frightening. It's good that people are concerned about
it. Right, I mean, it's frightening
enough than just being complacent. But I mean, I think people sometimes read, rather than saying, well, what's happening now is bad and we need to turn it around, people say what's happening now is bad and something like two orders of magnitude worse is right around the corner, which
right. I mean, there are two. You know, the I think the reasons to worry that something worse is around the corner are, well, maybe twofold. Maybe there are more. I mean, one is that one of the reasons the problems you're describing in American immigration went away to some extent was that America stopped immigration dead in the 1920s with a frankly pretty racist set of policies, and America was able to, you know, because we are separated by an ocean from Europe, was able to basically enforce a very strict no immigration policy for the next 35 years, 45, it was 20s to the late 60s. So, and during that period, you had, you know, essentially you just sort of took a pause and said, all right, we've got this population here, and we're going to assimilate them rigorously. All right, so it's threefold, right? So it's one, you had a pause. Then you have an economy that is in hindsight, I think looks ideally geared towards the assimilation of low-skilled immigrants. You mm-hmm. had an industrial economy run by kind of feudal barons who would, you know, mm-hmm. set up, you know, English language schools in their factories because they wanted workers who could speak English and so on. I mean, and it was, again, it was oppressive in many ways, but it was oppressive right. in ways that worked to further assimilation. So those two things seem to be at least somewhat absent in Europe. I mean, you know, you have immigration is not going on at the rates that was going on when you had huge guest worker programs, obviously in the 50s and 60s. But by the same, but one, Europe, you know, shares land mainly sea borders with these regions in ways that
right. Although I mean the actual volume of European immigration, even when it was high,
right, was not
much lower than in America at its high ebb, and now
right,
it's down.
Right. But so but still you are but you
yes,
are
I
also
mean, you're
dealing
not
with
see that
I mean,
clean
you know,
break.
These workers came when they came. There was an assumption that, you know, they were coming to fill holes in an industrial economy. They were
sure.
coming, you know, because of labor shortages.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that industrial economy really doesn't exist to the same extent. And
yeah.
you don't have... And at the same time, I mean, the other factor I think that worries people is just that, you know, the level of violence that's available to would-be terrorists is a lot more than throwing a bomb into a car that contains a couple of politicians. And that's I think, where, you know, to my mind, I basically assume that, you know, this is a problem. It's a big problem, but it will be a manageable problem for Europe over the next 50 years. However, you can imagine, in ways I think you couldn't in 1909, levels of escalation happening where, you know, you have massive bombings, for instance, in European cities that set off a kind of, you know, a sort of cycle of escalating tension that goes in really dark directions. Maybe.
All right.
Well, that's it, yeah.
I feel like we're running out of time. We were going to talk about Afghanistan, but instead all I will say is that even though I think you are overstating the case, still, if I were to be really worried about defending the United States or anyone from terrorism, I would spend more time worrying about, you know, the situation in Rotterdam and wherever
right.
else, than in rural Afghanistan, which is, after all, really far away. I mean, the best possible place from an American point of view for someone really interested in killing Westerners is rural Afghanistan, as best I can tell. Right? I mean, that's like the dream scenario to me. It's like he's in Helmand province, a million miles away, no direct flights to anywhere, no passport, better that he'd be nowhere, better that he'd be captured or killed or whatever, but the problem is that he could be in a, you know, visa waiver country.
But here's my question. You know, you were in a camp, and forgive me if I'm misrepresenting you in any way, but you were in a camp that thought during the course of the search debates in 2000
yeah.
and, you know, for 2006, let's say, that the sort of marginal value of adding U.S. troops anywhere was more likely to be felt in Afghanistan than in Iraq, right?
Yeah.
And I guess my question is just sort of what has changed since then? Just that Afghanistan
gotten
worse, or that...
Well, Afghanistan has gotten worse.
I
don't think anything has changed. I mean, I think that the policy which Obama is implementing of on net transferring troops from Iraq to Afghanistan, you know, it makes perfect sense within terms of the sort of four corners of its own debate,
right?
I mean, then there's a larger question about whether really investing so much in sort of the military and in military methods is really a good idea, right? I mean, I think, you know, like a lot of liberals, I'm always in the awkward position when it comes to foreign policy issues of, you know, kind of wanting to see practical politicians espouse much more radical critiques of the status quo than anyone is willing to do. So you sort of need to evaluate these policies on two levels,
right?
I mean, there's one within, like, the trade-offs that people are actually talking about. This seems like an okay trade-off to me. And then the other is, like, in a global sense, does it make sense that this is what we're talking about? And I think it doesn't. I think, you know, the political imperatives of arguing about the surge, you know, definitely led me to emphasize the first point and not say things like,
right.
This Iraq thing is probably about as good as anything else. It's all kind of a waste. You know, that's sort of how I feel.
Right. Well, no, I mean, I think that, you know, it is, I mean, this is both liberals and, you know, this sort of voices on the paleo-conservative right, I think, have this problem where your ideal policy is a kind of massive structural change in U.S. foreign policy that, you know, Barack Obama himself has explicitly ruled off. I mean, he said repeatedly, right, that, you know, there was never on the table a policy that would involve, you know, dramatic pullouts from Afghanistan. Right. And that creates a problem for you in terms of...
Well, and for everyone, right? I mean, because, like, so if, you know, so if General McChrystal says, well, okay, to do this mission, I can succeed with 95,000 troops, or however it is, and I will fail with 60,000 troops, then even if what you think is maybe, well, we should have fewer than 60,000, but the only things being discussed are 60,000 or 90,000,
right,
then, you know, I don't know, right? I mean, I don't want to say I'm an advocate of sending more resources into a place where I think maybe we should have less, but at the same time, I mean, it really doesn't make sense to just, like, to do something that's hugely costly, but that the people you've charged with undertaking it say will fail. You know, there's a logic to
right, but you don't think that there is.
It's not a logic I like to embrace.
Right, but I mean, you don't think that there is. You know, given the realities of the situation, given that we, you know, there was never a world, right, in which we weren't going to invade Afghanistan after 9/11 in some capacity, right?
No, which was fine. I have no
right,
problem
you have no problem with that. And you know, at a certain point where, you know, I assume that if you were drawing up the policy in an ideal world, somewhere around the point where Osama bin Laden eludes us in Tora Bora, you know, you begin maybe drawing down U.S. troop levels and saying, you know, well, we did our job, we're going to turn it over to Hamid Karzai's government and so on.
Well, of course, in an ideal world, that, you know.
Right, in an ideal world, we catch bin Laden, right, and so on. But I mean, you know, okay, so at a certain point in your ideal world, you want to say, well, we're going to draw down resources and turn things over to the government in Afghanistan, and, you know, if things go badly after that, well, there are more important countries in the world than Afghanistan. I mean, I think, you know, at a certain point, we have to do that. I guess the question
right.
is given that...
I mean,
given
I see
that,
why we didn't do it, right? I mean, given the Bush administration's sort of independent desire to invade Iraq, right, they wound up in... I think an understandable, but, you know, ultimately very pernicious kind of thing where they didn't want to say, okay, our view is that invading Iraq matters a lot more, like, say explicitly, matters a lot more than some random stabilizing Afghanistan thing.
Right.
We're washing our hands of this, we're going into Iraq, if Osama bin Laden pops up on our satellite, we're going to blow him up. You know, which would have made a certain amount of sense. Also would have made a certain amount of sense to, instead of sending all those people into Iraq, and in particular, instead of sending... I mean, we really, like, leaned on our more loyal foreign friends, you know, the British, the Polish, et cetera, to send troops to Iraq, that, you know, maybe you could have had an effort that was a lot more robust than the one they actually mounted in Afghanistan, but still much cheaper than what we're doing now. Maybe could have prevented this insurgency from arising. You know, there's a lot of things you could have done. Instead, it was sort of backburnered, but without any scaling back of the mission. You know, we would still say, "Oh, we're doing all right.
And they said, "Oh, we're not denying troop requests, but really they were
right.
denying troop requests and so on."
Right, right. And like, well, there's going to be democracy, but they weren't actually doing any of that stuff. So then we wound up by 2008, where, you know, we'd sort of written these enormous checks that you know, we were not prepared to cash. And then the opportunity arose as the situation in Iraq improved, and as Democrats were coming in to actually switch the resources back and try to cash those checks under kind of adverse circumstances, which... I mean, I think you'd have to say, I mean, this is not what anyone meant to do, exactly.
No, and there are layers upon layers, right? Because once you're in Iraq, I think you can, you know, I think there's a...
Well,
independent of what you think of the decision to invade Iraq, I think that in 2005, Iraq was a more important theater for the United States than Afghanistan. And so I think even if you think that, you know, the invasion was a mistake, that doesn't mean that once you're in... you know, you can't prioritize Iraq over Afghanistan. I mean, I guess the question that I, you know, I have sort of the, you know, I have sort of my big worry with the surge into Afghanistan, which, you know, maybe you're worried too, is that you know, Barack Obama doesn't believe in it, and liberals, you and other people, develop this kind of funny critique of sort of the conservative emphasis on willpower and psychology during the Green Lantern theory of foreign policy, where it's, you know, oh, if only we had enough will, we could deal with, you know, Kim Jong-il would just hand us his nuclear weapons if we just, you know, gave the right speeches. And I think that was a very valuable critique of certain, shall we say, excesses in conservative foreign policy rhetoric. But it is also the case that psychology and will and so forth do matter in foreign policy, and they do matter when you're embarking on a sort of military escalation. And I would like to feel that – I would like to feel more strongly that Barack Obama believes that this strategy will work than I did listening to his speech or do just sort of picking up vibes from around Washington.
Well – I think it's hard to say. I mean, in some ways, I would say that if I were assessing American resolve as a potential insurgent, that the most telling indicator about it would be that this is a policy that it seems basically no one supports, no one is enthusiastic about, but that the sort of grinding logic of politics is such that we're going to do it anyway. And political change in the United States can only, from this point, bring, I think, you know, more hawkish people into more and more political power, and we're sort of likely to, I don't know, stick around Afghanistan actually for quite a long time.
Interesting. So, not because Barack Obama in this moment in history feels compelled to escalate, then surely, you know, President Mitt Romney in 2012 won't be pulling us out.
Yeah, I mean, who says? I mean, you know, that's cute, obviously. But you know, I mean, I think, you know, if you look at, you know, Johnson in Vietnam, Nixon in Vietnam, it's very difficult. Or, you know, Bush in Afghanistan, it's and now Obama in Afghanistan, it's very difficult for an American president to decide he's giving up on a military operation. Sort of rarely happens, and when it did happen, it was happening under sort of real national security pressure of the Cold War, you know, when there was a sort of, you know, a real controlling, like, limiting concept on this, and if it really starts to seem to Richard Nixon that, like, what we're doing in Vietnam is not, in fact, a good way of fighting the Soviet Union, you can slowly and painfully sort of turn the battleship around and go do something else. Here it's, you know, I don't know. I mean, actually, if you propose, like, really alternative, like, ideas like, well, we shouldn't be spending all these resources in Afghanistan because we need to gear up for a war with China, you know, I don't know. I would rather spend them in Afghanistan. You know, massively scaling back the defense budget and, you know, putting the money into subway construction, you know, I would love, but that's not going to happen. So, you know, one of the things you sort of see from Iraq, right, is that we kind of stood there, and it, not even that, like, Bush stuck it out with enormous willpower, but he stuck it out with just enormous stick-to-itiveness, so that, like, when his policy was bad and was clearly failing, he still stuck with that for a really long time, and then when pushed to the very breaking point where the whole thing seemed politically unviable, then what they did was switch strategies. You know, and just because... it's hard. What you really don't want to do is say, yeah, you guys are right, this was all a waste of time. And I think that same logic applies in some ways even more strongly to a Democratic administration, given that Obama has committed himself to this course of action.
Right, except that Obama has, in a way that Bush didn't in 2006, a real domestic policy agenda that he wants to get enacted, and for which he needs both, you know, maybe he doesn't need any Republican support, but he certainly needs a unified party behind him. And that was what, yeah, I mean, this is part of what happened to LBJ.
Right, but the Johnson calculation, which I think is also in part the Obama calculation, is that it does more to hurt your domestic agenda to, you know, get in some fight with the military about what.
It does. It does at this point. But I think the question is what happens in 18 months. And I mean, it's a good question. I remember doing a blogging heads with Chris Hayes, the Nation's Washington correspondent, a long time ago, like 2 years ago or something. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, and Chris is very steeped in sort of the ways of the American left. And he said, you know, if Barack Obama doesn't get us out of Afghanistan, the left will turn on him completely. Afghanistan, Iraq. Iraq. This was back, you know, pre-surge and sort of pre-a lot of stuff. And so obviously some of those calculations have changed. Barack Obama is technically getting us out of Iraq, but very slowly, and that's not as big a deal to the left and so on. But Afghanistan is becoming a sort of Iraq-style big deal to the left. And if you read sort of, you know, I mean, don't want to put too much stock in what you read on the Huffington Post, but if you read the Huffington Post, you know, and if you listen to a lot of Democratic legislators, it's not completely crazy that Barack Obama could be in real political trouble with the left of his party and even facing some kind of primary challenger if we aren't in some way de-escalating from Afghanistan by 2012. Do you think that's crazy?
Well, I think a primary challenger is crazy. But I guess here's what I would say. I think there's a lot of scenarios in which you can imagine the sort of whole Obama administration, you know, bogging down in terrible political problems with, you know, problems with the left in Afghanistan, plus problems with the left over a sense that he hasn't actually delivered on his domestic agenda, while the right and the center feel the domestic agenda is too ambitious, and then Afghanistan is not resolute enough, or whatever. But I don't think any of those problems actually lead to withdrawal from Afghanistan. If anything, they just lead to Mitt Romney becoming president. If Obama can't make the political logic of the Obama coalition work, you know, what happens is probably he will lose. Conversely, I think that if he starts having successes in some areas, right? I mean, if the economy is growing, violence is somewhat down in Afghanistan, and there's this healthcare bill, and you know, whatever, then. You know, people will kind of shrug it off. It's why predicting the future is always hard because what will happen is not, you know, politically it's not independent of what actually happens in the world.
Right. No, that's true, and I think that there is a case to be made that in an America that has an all volunteer military, in a war that was never controversial the way Iraq was at its inception, and in a war that's happening at a time when, you know, newspapers are not exactly filling up their Kabul bureaus to cover the Afghanistan war, even with the escalation. Yeah, I think you could imagine if things are going better for Obama, this Afghanistan just being kind of like the imperial wars of the British Empire in the late 19th century, not the Boer War, but some of the ones in Africa, where it's just something that the mass of Americans kind of take for granted as a sort of ongoing unpleasantness.
Well, or, I mean, like Iraq.
Well, right, like Iraq and Obama. Right. But this is what obviously I'm hoping for, is that I think, you know, there you did, you know, we can debate how much you achieved, but something real was achieved in terms of stabilizing
the situation.
Yeah, no, I mean,
exactly. I mean the situation improved. I mean, it's just that it... What was I going to say? I mean... Objectively, the situation in Iraq is still, like, fairly tenuous. It just improved enough, and American news organizations' desire to do lots and lots of coverage from Iraq declined enough to the point where it's not the subject of ongoing. You know, there was a huge bombing in Iraq last night or yesterday or something like that, and, you know, and nobody cares. Whereas, 2 years ago, that would have been a huge deal. And, you know, Afghanistan... Assuming this policy has some measure of success, I think it easily go in that direction, you know, where the country still has all kinds of problems, but the trend line is not getting dramatically worse, and in fact is somewhat better, and so everyone just kind of needs to pronounce themselves happy with the situation.
Right. Well, on that, we've
so
struck...
You're happy with the duration
of this?
We've
struck a lot of cheerful notes.
All right.
So, Matt, it was a pleasure.
Indeed.
And we will talk again soon.
Okay.
All right. Take care.
Bye.